God, what a deal.
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving, and I'm very glad to welcome you, Ken Root.
Thanks. The most important shocking news of the week.
Charlie Crist. Is going to run as an independent. Wow, when did that thought occur to him? Possibly when he dropped 25 points behind Marco Rubio in the Republican primary?
You know something? We talk about frontrunners. We talked about frontrunners all last year, just as Hillary Clinton was the frontrunner in 2007. Charlie Crist was the frontrunner in 2009. Once you get closer to what voters actually care about and not what media big shots like Ron Elving think.
Note to self, do not be frontrunner 1 year too early.
Although Barack Obama was the frontrunner the day of the New Hampshire primary in which he lost, but still... This is a perfect example of a front-runner strategy that went woefully wrong.
So everyone involved in political punditry really should just hang it up and retire at this point.
Well, no, but I think
that's it for this week's political podcast.
Well, that's it for Charlie Crist, and that's for sure.
Let's throw out, just for devil's advocate, because I know that the conventional wisdom is that this is a last hurrah and a swan song and a complete suicide mission for Charlie Crist.
No, he has no chance. No, it's not a suicide mission. It's his only chance to win.
Of course it's his only chance, and has been for some while. Right. He's been wriggling on the pin. He had to do this if he wanted to remain in politics. His only chance... other than this, would have been to wait for a future Republican president to appoint him to some cabinet position, which isn't going to happen now that he's a man with... Well, wasn't going to happen anyway.
Or maybe John McCain could pick him as a running mate in 2008.
As he, of course, didn't do in 2008. And that, in a sense, was the zenith of Mr. Crist's career.
It was.
He reached the point of being mentioned for vice president, which, of course, inevitably leads to people mentioning you for president.
Right.
Then... he plummeted almost immediately after that.
It's one thing to hug John McCain in 2008. It was another thing to hug Barack Obama in 2009, and that was the beginning of the end for Charlie Crist.
Would you say he hugged one guy too many?
Well, it's exactly what Joe Lieberman did in 2006 in Connecticut. He hugged the other president, George Bush, to his detriment, lost the primary to...
I think that was a hug and a kiss, though, was it not?
The difference between Connecticut and Joe Lieberman in 2006 and Charlie Crist is that in Florida, you cannot run... and lose a primary, as Joe Lieberman did, and then run as an independent. You have to decide. And Thursday of this week, Charlie Crist has decided to leave the Republican primary, which he was not going to win anyway.
Well, of course, Lieberman had a chance of winning the Democratic primary back then and defeating Ned Lamont once and for all. He did not do so, but he had a shot. It's clear that Crist had no shot here, and he was basically into the world of waiting for somebody to be nice to him after this. Or... making one more bid to actually win this contest. Now, there's a long way between April, where we are now, the current month, and November, when the general election on these three candidates
meet.
November
2nd.
And I'd just like to throw out the thought that Charlie Crist, even in the Rasmussen poll, which is the most favorable poll for Marco Rubio.
In a three-way race.
Even in that poll, Crist is within 10 percentage points. It's 5, 6, 7 points that he's behind. If he were to take, let's say, half of Kendrick Meek's support.
Kendrick Meek, the likely Democratic nominee.
That's right. And we assume that Marco Rubio does not take much of Meek's support.
Like zero.
That would put him back on top. Right. If, of course, he does not lose a lot of the support that he has at this particular time to Marco Rubio in the ensuing weeks. He may lose some of that because there may be some people who are just that unhappy with him for running third party, and there doubtless will be many. But it's possible he's lost as many people as he was ever going to lose on the Republican side, and he could start building back using largely Democrats and independents.
That's certainly possible. And, you know, if we believe that people say that they're tired of politics as usual, they're tired of the partisanship, what better example than Charlie Crist saying, I reject the extremes of the left of the Democratic Party, I reject the extremes of the right of the Republican Party, and here I am running as a centrist. The problem is he has... a lot of it has to do with Charlie Crist. He has alienated a lot of people, not because...
personally.
It's one thing to talk about ambition, and everybody who runs for office is ambitious, but Charlie Crist has always been seen as somebody running for office, always looking at the next election. Perhaps Barack Obama had the same criticism when he ran
indeed
for Congress,
he did. Indeed
ran for
he did.
The Senate, ran for president, blah, blah, blah.
Doesn't seem to have held him back much.
No, and he's now president of the United States, according to some people.
A large percentage of the American populace does believe he is president.
Now, you know, we keep talking about the rise of the Tea Party and how the Republican Party has moved steadily further and further to the right. If that's the case, then maybe Marco Rubio's numbers have peaked. And then Kendrick Meek, who we should mention is African-American, and Florida does not have a reputation of electing black politicians to statewide office.
Like ever.
Like, exactly. And so perhaps maybe there is Democrats who are maybe not crazy about Kendrick Meek.
Well, maybe they'd like Kendrick Meek, but they can read the standings. And they shift to Crist because they prefer him to Marco Rubio. They don't want to see Florida represented by a movement Tea Party loved, beloved candidate like Marco Rubio, somebody who many are suggesting could be the Republican equivalent or the Republican answer, if you will, to Barack Obama, that he's that kind of skyrocket. Some Democrats are going to say, we can't win it outright with Meek. We're going to shift over to Crist and at least frustrate this Rubio business.
True, although I think that if that were the case, Charlie Crist would still caucus with the Republicans, just as Joe Lieberman caucused with the Democrats, even though the Democrats rejected him.
Granted, right? Granted, he's not going to caucus with the Democrats in all likelihood. But I also see him being a kind of Republican we don't have many of in the current Senate. And that would be the kind of Republican perhaps Mike Castle from Delaware would also be, or possibly
Mark Kirk
right? from Illinois. Two other guys who are in very good position to be in the next United States Senate as Republicans, but not as the kind of Republican we've seen blocking consideration of the financial regulatory bill or fighting health care hammer and tong. We would not expect them to be that kind of Republican.
If Charlie Crist is the kind of Republican who will stick to his philosophy, whatever that philosophy is, it may be a Charlie Crist-only philosophy, but the point is he has not knuckled under to the right wing, for example, on the teacher bill.
He vetoed the teacher bill.
Exactly. So compare him a little bit to somebody who used to be kind of Charlie Crist-esque.
John McCain.
John McCain. I know the media was always in love with John McCain. Certainly they were in 2000 when he ran against George W. Bush, the Straight Talk Express, things like that. And he did do a lot of straight talk, certainly for a Republican, on issues that broke with the party hierarchy on many key issues.
Which is why reporters loved him, because right. he said things that were supposed to be impolitic for a Republican.
But I've never seen somebody completely throw out whatever philosophy.
Total political identity?
Completely. And especially on something like near and dear to John McCain's heart has always been immigration. He was one of the few Republicans, along with President Bush, who believed in outreach to Hispanics and believed in path to citizenship for the 12 million people here illegally.
John McCain was still using the word amnesty positively in the year 2003. He was calling the program that he was putting forward as part of comprehensive immigration amnesty.
And as recently as 2006, 2 years before he ran for president, he was still pushing this liberalized bill that the Chamber of Commerce liked, that the president liked, that the
Jeb Bush in Florida liked.
But most Republicans in Congress, the J.D. Hayworths, and there were a lot of J.D. Hayworths in Congress in the Republican Party in 2006, as there are probably even more so now, who said this is amnesty, this is not the way to go. The first thing we need to do is tighten up the border, the porous border with Mexico. But as Arizona was about to pass this very strict, severe, stringent law on immigration, John McCain said this is the right way to go. And this is completely, I mean, I wonder when he looks in the mirror what he sees and who he sees.
Well, who he sees is J.D. Hayworth right. over his shoulder. And you brought up J.D. Hayworth just a moment ago as somebody who not very long ago was thought of as being kind of an anachronism, a guy from the class of 1994, the Gingrich Revolution, who was dismissed by the voters in a Republican district 12 years later when they voted for the mayor of Tempe, Harry Mitchell, to take over there. 4 points in a very Republican district. People thought, well, that's the end of J.D. Hayworth. He was rejected even in his own district.
As Hayworth ran on a very anti-immigrant platform. Right.
Exactly. And now, here we are 4 years later, and J.D. Hayworth is back on the scene challenging John McCain. And whether he beats him in the primary in Arizona or not, he has changed John McCain so fundamentally. I don't know if anyone's ever going to be able to see the man the same way again.
And if we're talking about the fight for the Republican Party soul, we see it in Florida with Crist versus Rubio, in Arizona with McCain versus Hayworth. There was a fight for the Democratic Party soul going on in Arkansas as well. Blanche Lincoln, a centrist, moderate, sometimes overcautious Democrat, whom many Democrats think is too much of a Republican for their likes.
Almost a dino.
Right, a dino, Democrat in name only. And she's being challenged by Bill Halter, the lieutenant governor, who is backed by the MoveOn.orgs and the
labor union.
And the labor unions.
People who want to be more aggressive.
Right. And also the fact that, you know, she wavered on the public option. She was for it, then she was against it.
Oh, she's back and forth on the health care bill on the main votes. She voted one way and then the other.
And so if we're talking about what the Tea Party and the conservatives are doing to the Republican Party, here is the liberal slash left wing of the Democratic Party making its voice heard in Arkansas, in a state that is not... Look, first of all, Barack Obama only won 39% of the vote in Arkansas. It's tough for Blanche Lincoln to run while you have the John Boozmans and the Gilbert Bakers and the Republicans of that state saying she's a lefty, while at the same time you have the Bill Halters and the MoveOn.org saying she's a righty, puts her in a very interesting, awkward position.
She has tried through her career basically to be kind of a centrist Democrat, which used to be where you wanted to be in Arkansas in the Bill Clinton era, if you will, the Dale Bumpers era, the David Pryor era. His son is still in the Senate carrying on those traditional politics. But it's not working for Blanche Lincoln. Why can't she make it work when it's been the formula in Arkansas for so long?
Well, because I think there was a lot of emotions going on during the health care bill. The Democrats and the labor unions and the left knew that they had 60 votes for the longest time. There was no reason why there should have been such a protracted battle over health care that they had to wait for Scott Brown to win Massachusetts and rob them of the 60 votes. They had the 60 votes with Joe Lieberman and Ben Nelson and Blanche Lincoln, and they were all demanding their own little piece of the pie. And while doing that, the Obama legacy was in trouble because it took longer and longer and longer to pass. And so a lot of people blame Blanche Lincoln for that caution, that, you know, that she's trying so hard to be a centrist that she forgot her party roots. And I think that's what's behind Bill Halter's campaign. Now, there's a possibility that this may go into a June runoff. Right now, the last polls I saw in Arkansas show that Blanche Lincoln's up maybe 7-8 points over Halter. Could be closer, who knows? There was a debate last weekend where Halter apparently did very well. There's a mixed bag on that, but obviously it wasn't Lincoln Douglas, it was more Lincoln Halter. Different debate.
But the dynamics of something like this usually are that if the upstart, the non-incumbent, knocks the incumbent into a runoff, and then it's a smaller electoral universe yet in the runoff vote, usually the excited partisans of the challenger prevail.
Sometimes.
In the runoff.
As you well remember, in 1972, when David Pryor took on John McClellan, he did bring him into a runoff, but he didn't beat him into the runoff. Remember that?
That was the Arkansas Democratic primary in 1972.
And two years later.
It is etched on my memory.
But 2 years later, the last Democratic senator to be defeated in Arkansas.
William Fulbright.
By Dale Bumpers. Classic.
The young Dale Bumpers, right. Later to be famous for giving the most eloquent speech in defense of his Arkansas colleague Bill Clinton in the impeachment trial in 1999.
We're here today because the president suffered a terrible moral lapse, a marital infidelity, not a breach of the public trust, not a crime against society, the two things Hamilton talked about in Federalist Paper number 65. I recommend it to you before you vote. But it was a breach of his marriage vows. It was a breach of his family trust. It is a sex scandal.
But just to get back to Planet 21st Century, one of the things that has been happening in the Senate just this week has been a battle to get the financial re-regulation bill, another centerpiece, one of the last pieces of the centerpiece of the Barack Obama agenda, to the floor of the Senate for a final debate. And here, Blanche Lincoln played a key role in getting not only the agricultural derivatives portion of the bill done in her committee, but also fashioning the treatment of the derivatives issue, which is terribly important to all of this Wall Street consideration, in a way that not only got the Democrats together as a complete party, but also brought over Charlie Grassley's vote. And that was key in moving this whole thing forward. So she has at least a very inside the beltway credential there. She has a victory there, something that you would think would mean something to the voters in Arkansas. Maybe that's a little bit of a breeze blowing back the other way in her favor.
Bigger picture for Washington, though, it seems like the Democrats got everything they wanted this week with the financial regulation. One, that the Republican opposition crumbled under popular opinion. Harry Reid, to his credit, insisted that the Senate have back-to-back-to-back votes to point out Republican obstinance. But I think at the same time, Goldman Sachs played a big part in helping the Democrats get their victory.
Yes, in the same way that Wellfleet, Anthem, Blue Cross in California raising their health insurance premiums 39%.
Perfect timing.
Incredibly early this year, at a time when many people thought that the health care legislation was just dead in the water. That particular business decision helped regenerate the energy behind that bill and move it again, really reignited the whole debate. And I think we saw this with, in this case, a somewhat less, shall we say, business decision, a government decision by the SEC to sue the Goldman Sachs firm for this one particular investment product that they were betting for and against. That seems to have distilled the attitude towards what has gone on in Wall Street in recent years, and which may not be responsible entirely for the recession, may not be responsible exactly for the mortgage meltdown. Many, many things were at play there. But this symbolizes the way Wall Street profits from the misery of others at exactly the moment when the Democrats are trying to bring this new Wall Street rule to the floor. It was a huge benefit for them.
If we agree that Goldman Sachs certainly helped the Democrats with the financial reg stuff, if we agree that Anthem Blue Cross helped the Democrats during the health care debate, what do we make of what happened in Arizona last week with the immigration bill getting a bill to Congress? First of all, let me just say one thing about this. I feel that for all the criticism made against the Arizona legislature who passed this bill, it's ultimately the lack of action by Congress, and certainly they've tried, Republicans have tried, Democrats have tried, but it's the lack of action by Congress that has made Arizona take such severe measures.
And so what is the reaction of each of the two major political parties? To act or not to act?
Well, I don't know the answer to this. And the reason I don't know the answer to this is because it's in the Democrats' court. They have the presidency. They have the microphone. They have Congress. And yet there are a lot of Democrats who say, do I want to go out and sell an immigration bill with 10% unemployment while they're taking our jobs? I mean, it's ridiculous and it's ludicrous and it's demagoguery, but sometimes demagoguery works in this country.
But there's only been one Republican who was willing to even negotiate on an immigration bill with the Democrats. That was Lindsey Graham from South Carolina. And when the Democrats said, we want to bring up an immigration bill, Lindsey Graham's reaction was, if you do that, I'm not going to negotiate any further to bring that bill to the floor. And what's more, I'll pull out of my negotiations on the climate change bill as well. We can't have an immigration bill out of Washington. What we need is border enforcement. Let's keep every last person from crossing the border, and then we can talk about a comprehensive reform of the kind that Lindsey Graham himself favors and of the kind that John McCain, as we talked earlier in the podcast, has been favoring for years. The Republican Party has bailed on comprehensive immigration reform. All they want now is a border that no one can cross.
Yeah, but try to find some Democrats who disagree with that, because if you ask Harry Reid, he'll say the same thing. He said the first thing we're going to do is secure the border.
But not without moving forward on comprehensive reform as well, because you can't do one without the other.
But there's a priority, and Harry Reid will argue, and the Democrats will argue, that what the American people want first is the border being fixed, and then you go on to the other.
I understand that, but we'll revisit this as we go through the year, and we'll see what happens to it. My strong belief is that this will make financial regulation and health care look like totally bipartisan bills. When it comes to immigration, there will be absolutely no bipartisanship.
You expect it to, with the Supreme Court nomination coming up this summer, you do expect immigration to reach the floor?
I expect that the Democrats will bring forward a bill which the Republicans will not allow on the floor of the Senate. And it will originate in the Senate, and it will die there. And the House won't bother to take a vote because the Senate is refusing to act. And I'm sorry to say, I think the same thing is true of climate change, where there was some prospect, particularly after health care got through, that the two sides, both wanting to do something about climate change, both caring about both the energy issues involved and the environment issues involved, were ready to deal. And now that appears to have been blown up as well.
Before we go, three primaries coming up on Tuesday. There were no primaries in April. Now, May is a big month for primaries. Obviously, we'll talk about Arkansas and Pennsylvania and Kentucky coming up. But this Tuesday, we have three states, Ohio, the Senate race, where George Voinovich is giving up his seat in North Carolina, the Democratic primary for the seat held by Richard Burr.
Is that headed for a runoff, Ken?
It could. There are three candidates in North Carolina. You have Ken Lewis, who's African-American. You have Elaine Marshall, who is the Secretary of State, four-term Secretary of State, who has run for the Senate once before, lost to Erskine Bowles. And you have this guy, Cal Cunningham, an Iraq War veteran, a one-term member of the state legislature.
Closing fast.
The folks in Washington seem to be very high on.
They recruited him.
They did, because Elaine Marshall, they feel, is not raising enough money, and she's just not strong enough to beat Burr in November. And the third state, of course, is Indiana. Where Evan Bayh gave up his seat, and there's a Republican primary. The top two candidates there are Dan Coats, the former senator, John Hustler, the former congressman, who lost his seat in 2006 to...
Just like J.D. Hayworth.
...to Brad Ellsworth, who will be the Democratic nominee, because why dropped out so late, that there's no primary for the Democrats.
It's a put-up job. It's a fix.
The news of the week, though, is that in the Ohio Democratic primary for the Senate, Lee Fisher, the lieutenant governor, has a big lead over Attorney General Jennifer Bruner. And the only difference there really seems to be is who has a better shot in November against Rob Portman, the former Bush trade secretary.
So this would appear to be the answer of how does Rob Portman make the next step? We've talked for years about how Rob Portman was on short lists for vice president.
He was my first pick until I wisely went to Tim Pawlenty.
That was inspired. And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.